Hi everyone, welcome to our latest Artemis Live podcast episode, which this week features another session from our recent virtual ILS Asia conference. In this session from the conference, we hear from Franz Josef Hahn, who's CEO of Hong Kong headquartered reinsurer Peak Re, and also Ian Reynolds, who's the director and head of analytics at Peak Re. The pair gave a keynote presentation on the developing Asia reinsurance and ILS market and also shared some thoughts with us on Peak Re's own opportunity in ILS as well. They highlighted during the keynote that there's a rapidly increasing level of probable maximum losses across Asia as development and urbanisation accelerates at scale in the region, and obviously a lot of this region is catastrophe exposed, which also highlights the need for more insurance and reinsurance capital, but also the need for better data and modelling to support risk transfer as well. And the pair also highlighted the opportunity for deployment of capital into the burgeoning risks growing in Asia. The scale of the PMLs that Peak Re believes will accumulate in areas like the Greater Bay region of China suggests that insurance linked securities and the capital markets have an essential role to play in supporting expansion of insurance across these regions, the pair said. As a result, Peak Re's CEO, Franz Josef Hahn, said that ILS capital can support the emerging opportunity for underwriting Asian risks, and he highlighted his company Peak Re's partnership role with investors, as well as its recent investment into the segment directly through its acquisition of Lutece and the formation of its own ILS fund manager Peak Capital. After the keynote, I spent 15 minutes quizzing Franz and Ian, which you can hear at the end of this podcast episode as well. I hope you enjoy this and stay tuned to Artemis at www.artemis.bm.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you are. This is ILS Asia, recorded from Hong Kong. Asia and the Indian subcontinent are housing 65% of the global population. The GDP purchasing power parity growth from 2010 to 2019 was in China from 8,800 to 16,000, so it's almost doubled. In India, which is a bit slower in the development and coming or trailing China in its own developments of the GDP, but also development of the insurance sector, was growing in the same period from 4,200 to 6,700. In parallel to the GDP growth, both countries were growing the insurance sector over the same period on a CAGR of 15%. 15% China and 15% India, and the other markets surrounding in the emerging Asian markets have been growing in a similar way. The insurance penetration in P&C, and I'm only referring to P&C insurance penetration, in the same period was below 1% in China and grown in 2019 up to 1.3%. In India, during the same period for P&C, the penetration grown from 0.56% to 1%. The average global insurance penetration is around 6%. Now, this is including life and health and P&C. Normally, we can see by looking through the entire list of the various insurance markets that the life penetration is much bigger than the P&C penetration in general. The P&C penetration is approximately one-fourth to one-third in most of the countries. So the 6% penetration, which I mentioned before on the global average, would be around 2%. So India and China and many other emerging Asian markets are far below the penetration ratio of the Western world, for instance. Now, China and India are not the only fast-growing emerging Asian markets, but they are growing on a much larger scale. Asia and the Indian subcontinent are facing a much higher frequency of natural catastrophes than any other continent in the world. Now, the growth of wealth, and specifically the growth of wealth in the middle-class society of emerging Asia, which is the strongest backbone of sustainable growth of the societies, has been along the fault lines of earthquakes as well as along where typhoons usually hit, along the coastal areas of Asia, as well as the areas of, let me give you an example, for instance, Tianjin and Beijing, two mega cities in the north of China, which had been hit by a serious earthquake, one of the strongest we know in history, had been hit around 50 years ago. Another area where earthquakes are happening are India, the Gujarat, the northwestern Gujarat area, which is very well developed, as well as Jakarta, for instance. Due to the low penetration, historically, the NatCat events have led to a higher economic but very, very low insurance losses. The growth potential, therefore, is very large and opens opportunities to the insurance sector. And this opportunity will last for a very long period of time, 2 to 3 decades and beyond. The middle-class society is growing very fast in those areas, and the biggest, or one of the biggest reasons why the penetration has not been growing faster in 30 years, and why it is still for India only at 1%, and in China 1.3%, has a lot to do that the emerging middle-class society is growing year by year. Year by year, the middle-class society is growing around by 150 million people. So 150 million more people entering the middle-class society of emerging Asia, including Indian subcontinent. 150 million is as much as the total population of Russia and is as much as the total population of France and Germany together. So with this situation, we can see that today the insurance penetration is still very low, and it will grow over time. Let me give you an example in comparison America, USA, and emerging Asia. In the US, Hurricane Sandy has hit in 2012, and an insurance payout of more than 80, almost 90%. Half a year later, Typhoon Haiyan had been hitting the Philippines, the coastline town of Tacloban. It's a mid-sized city, was very well developed, and nothing has been standing any longer. The mean mid 10 minutes speed of Haiyan was 230 kilometers. The highest speed measured over 1 minute was 315 kilometers per hour. As I said, nothing was standing any longer, and the insurance system did not work very well. The insurance payouts were below 10%. Now, if I put your attention on the China coast, very close to Hong Kong and Macau, westward of it, very close to here, Typhoon Hato has been hitting in 2017, and the insurance loss payout was around 10% as well. With this, and with this huge opportunity of growth and sustained growth over the next decades, we can see a strong entering of natural catastrophe protection covers into the insurance system. And that's why it doesn't take me any wonder why Singapore and Hong Kong are preparing their capabilities for housing ILS structures. And we have seen the first arrival of funds who are also specializing on ILS, both in Hong Kong and Singapore. And it will not take long time that capital specifically from the northern, very capital-rich area of Asia, Japan, Korea, South Korea, and China, will enter existing funds or will start new startups, funds which will also manage ILS risk. Thanks for your attention. The next speaker following me is Mr. Ian Reynolds. He is the head of analytics in PCRI. Thank you.
Thank you, Franz. And good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. I'd like to add a few details to what Franz has been talking about and a couple of specific examples of where we think ILS really has potential to enable the growth of the insurance market in Asia Pacific. I'm going to work on the assumption that everybody in the audience knows enough about the developed insurance markets in Asia. We think there's probably more fresh material for you if we talk about emerging Asia. One thing to which we think really lends itself to ILS is that a lot of insurance support for emerging economies does really lend itself to environmental, social, and governance considerations, which we know is a big topic amongst the investor community. Specifically, the type of insurance products that we think may have potential in the ILS space are listed on the slide. Clearly, there's a lot of catastrophe risk, as Franz has mentioned, in emerging Asia. On top of that, we think there's a lot of agriculture, which can be very well supported in emerging Asia. As Franz mentioned, 65% of the world's population lives in Asia, and the two largest countries in Asia, India and China, are net exporters of crops, which is not true of many developed economies. We also see that we think there could be potential for critical illness insurance cover in the ILS space. The reason we think this is the suitability we're measuring is in terms of volume. It needs to be reasonably large, it needs to be reasonably volatile, and of course, ILS lends itself to short-tailed insurance risk. Critical illness does have a short tail. A lot of these products are based upon a fixed indemnity payout upon diagnosis, so there's very little tail risk on these products. More pertinent to ESG considerations, emerging Asia is also home to a lot of microinsurance. There's a lot of renewable energy risk here, and there's a lot of sustainable transport. All of these things are definitely worth considering in ESG terms. But I think where the real volume is at the moment and the obvious need is in catastrophe risk and agriculture, and I will talk a little bit about that. So we always talk about China at these events, so we thought it would be interesting to start off talking about India. India, as the audience probably know, is the world's seventh largest economy. The GDP is impressive, obviously, at 2.6 trillion, but the target GDP over the next decade is huge. If all targets are met, the GDP could reach 10 trillion by 2032. Not only is the potential impressive, the past performance has been impressive over the last decade. There's an annual growth of over 7%. Clearly, it's a huge population, but the really interesting things about the demographics in India are that the workforce are over 500 million people, but more importantly, that over 50% of the population is under the age of 25. So there's a huge demographic shift towards those who are educated and those who are entering the workforce. And a final point, which is really important in terms of insurance, is that India operates under common law. So in terms of the potential for insurance, one of the things which we really think might drive the growth in India is the infrastructure plans which the government have. There are a lot of different estimates for the size of it, but they are all measured in trillions of investment in infrastructure over the next 5 to 10 years. If we return to agriculture, which we want to talk about specifically in India, agriculture is about 14% of GDP currently. It employs over 50% of the workforce, and it constitutes 10% of Indian exports. If we talk specifically about agriculture insurance in India, there are many different products out there, but the one which really drives the growth at the moment is the Prime Minister scheme, commonly known by the initials PMFBY. This scheme has been in place since 2016, since when it has grown to, we estimate the gross written premium for 2020 will be, the 2020 underwriting year will be $3.5 billion. It's worth pointing out that people always talk about the potential of cyber, but the cyber industry is much smaller than that and has taken much longer to get there. The insurance scheme is a subsidized product, as most agricultural insurance is. It's a joint subsidy from the state or the regional and the national government. The product itself is yield-based, and the yield is estimated from on a regional level by samples referred to as crop-cutting experiments. So the product works on a payout estimated by a sample threshold yield, a sample in comparison to a target threshold yield per crop. The scheme is administered on a state level, and individual insurers bid for a three-year mandate for a given region. The region is called a cluster. The target client base for this is the loney farmers in India. Those are the farmers who are taking out bank loans to buy the seeds for the crops which they will grow. Now, why do we think this lends itself to ILS? Well, there are three reasons. One is the size, $3.5 billion of income. Second is the volatility, which we'll come to, and third is the short tail. And the short tail is demonstrated in this slide. This demonstrates the how the underwriting year unfolds for crop in India. If we look at calendar quarter two, the treaty renewals are carried out at 1/4. And shortly after that, we have the Kharif season. There are two growing seasons in India. There's Kharif, which is the summer season, and there's Rabi, which is the winter season. And really by the start of quarter four calendar year, the crop cutting and the harvest estimates, the yield estimates for Kharif will be completed. Then we go into the winter season. And by the end of Q1, prior to the renewal, the crop cutting yield threshold yield estimates will be done for Rabi. So within the space of a calendar year, we have two seasons and estimated yields. So this really does lend itself to a short. This really is short-tailed, and it lends itself to ILS in that the underwriting year is the accident year, is the financial year, and there's very little tail. There's some tail, but nothing too onerous and nothing large compared to catastrophe business, for example. Another reason why we think it lends itself to ILS is that it is modelable. So what you see here is an EP curve of market loss ratio against return period. This is from an internal model, one of our own internal models. There are commercial and independent models available, comparing underwriting years 18 and 19. What you can see is there's plenty of tail risk, which lends itself to reinsurance protection, but of course there's significant upside as well. So in summary, we think that there's lots of room for ILS to support agriculture in India. But it's not just agriculture. I also mentioned catastrophe risk. If we look at catastrophe risk in India, what we see on the right-hand side of this slide is a map of India with where the earthquake risk is. And we're comparing this with a picture on the left from NASA of activity at nighttime. And nighttime is not necessarily the human activity at nighttime is not necessarily the best proxy for industrial output, but it does tell you where people are located. And you can see very well that along the Himalayan belt, there's lots of people and there's lots of earthquake risk. As Franz has mentioned, there's an earthquake risk in Gujarat and some in Maharashtra, and that's also where there are large numbers of people. Finally, there is considerable cyclonic wind risk as well, all along the coast, and there are large cities all along the coast, both the west and east coasts. So, enough on India. I would also like to talk a little bit about China, and one part of China we'd like to talk about, which we haven't spoken about in previous conferences, is the Greater Bay Area project. And the Greater Bay Area is a conurbation in southern China. It's of 11 cities all around the Pearl River Delta. And this is a huge project for the Chinese government to integrate these economies. And the reason why this is really exciting is that we have, in these 11 cities, we have really all major industry segments. We have finance, we have entertainment, we have manufacturing, transport, cargo, service industries, really the whole lot. Now, people who talk about the Greater Bay Area like to compare it to other Bay Areas in the developed world. And specifically, people always talk about Tokyo, New York Bay Area, and the San Francisco Bay Area. And here we have some key statistics comparing the Greater Bay Area with those three other regions. And you can see that for these statistics that we've picked, the Greater Bay Area is generally larger in everything other than GDP. The GDP currently of the Greater Bay Area is comparable, but slightly smaller than New York and Tokyo. But the reason why this is so exciting is that the target GDP by the end of the decade is over $4 trillion. So it could triple in the next decade. Now, if we look at then, in terms of modeling, what the insurance PML is for these regions, for the three developed markets, those PMLs are estimated to be over $50 billion. Whereas the PML currently in the Greater Bay Area is probably less than $5 billion. But just imagine the growth potential there. New York is hurricane exposed, and the Greater Bay Area is also tropical wind exposed. New York is outside of the tropics, it's 40 degrees latitude. So all hurricanes approaching New York are weakening. Whereas the Bay Area is at 22 degrees latitude, it's within the tropics. So hurricanes or typhoons will be at full strength as they enter the area. And really the reason the PML is so low is the insurance penetration is low. But if we could match the insurance penetration to New York and triple the economy, the PML will be huge. And the requirement for ILS to support the insurance industry in this region would be massive. So, is there any experience? Well, there is. What we've seen in 2017 and 2018, in successive years, there were typhoons coming very close, not really making a direct hit on the Greater Bay Area, but bypassing, and not hugely strong. There were probably around Cat 2 typhoons. Hato in 2017 was a much more narrow storm. Mangkhut was actually further out in terms of its track, but it was a much wider storm. If we look at the insurance losses from those two events, we can see that despite the low insurance penetration, despite the relatively low intensity of the events, and despite the fact that there wasn't a direct hit on any of the cities here, we have two successive years of around $1 billion loss here. So if we can grow the insurance penetration and we can grow the economies, the potential to support insurance with ILS will be huge. Finally, in terms of ILS, it needs to be measurable. So we'd just like to add that the typhoon risk really supported by technology in this region. So specifically, there are several vendor models covering typhoon risk in the Greater Bay Area. There's a lot of local reinsurance expertise. And all of the supporting technology which you see in more developed markets, such as seasonal forecasting. Here you see a seasonal forecast from ourselves and the Shanghai Typhoon Institute, live tracking. All of this technology is in place. What's not in place is the support that's required to develop the economy. But the potential is huge. And with that, we'd like to thank you very much, and we'll move on to the questions.
Franz, Ian, thanks so much for the insightful keynote speech today. You painted a really interesting picture of the growth potential for ILS in Asia with some really useful data for our viewers as well. So to continue along in the same vein, where do you see the emerging Asia region from the catastrophe risk penetration point of view?
The cat penetration will naturally grow as it has been growing over the last two decades already, very strongly. PMLs accumulations very strongly along the rich part of Asia, along the, when I'm using again the emerging Asian area. China is the largest emerging market, and the richest part is along the coastline. That's where you will see the further growth of the PMLs. I have one example. Typhoon Fito, I think it was 2013, has been hitting the Fujian area, which is very close to Taiwan Island, and it had been hitting a pocket, which was surprising us. At that time, we were a young company, and we were seeing accumulations, which I have not seen before. And it has shown that the accumulation is growing very rapidly. And the PMLs are growing very, very rapidly. And if that would happen this year, I think we would get a multiple of what we have seen in 2013. That's how fast the market is growing. I've been talking about a growth of the Indian and of the Chinese economy and of the insurance growth in those markets, but also in the other Southeast Asian markets. And that's around 15% over a CAGR of, let's say, 5 or 9 years. And we see a little dot this year because of what's happening with COVID. But we see that China is coming back faster than any other economy. It's now the forecast at 1% growth for this year, which is extraordinarily. And next year they are poised to move on from where they came from. And those accumulations go alongside the general growth of the industry, because natural catastrophe, specifically industrial and commercial, is in the forefront of the Chinese clients. In the forefront of the regulators in the region is, of course, the protection for individuals, and the assets they are building. This wealth should not be destroyed. In the past, larger events in China, they have been affecting approximately 8 percentage points of the GDP in the annum where it has been happening. And the Chinese government, the Indian government, and all the governments, they are interested that the private industry is taking that up now and can give sufficient protection against earthquake, but also against typhoon, flood, and any other calamity. So this will be going on, growing very, very strongly. And you cannot take data from 2 years ago if you want to do a proper job. That's why we have Ian and his team within us here in Hong Kong. That's a huge team. I think it's the biggest of all the reinsurers here in Asia, and we are doing the modeling live on each and every case. And that's what is being advised when you're working in emerging markets. The landscape is changing very fast.
Absolutely. No, it's very interesting. And obviously, While penetration is beginning to catch up with some of the more developed markets, such as the US, there's still significant differences in the way the market operates there. How does Asian cat risk generally differ to the US, which is where the ILS market is much more familiar in terms of penetration rates and how much actually gets reinsured?
Well, it's a good question, and it does very much depend upon how you want to measure this. Obviously, regulatory regimes are very different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. People's risk appetite and what they're prepared to cover themselves to changes. I think if we assume premium is the best proxy, then we think the US market is probably about 60% of the cat premium worldwide. And Asia Pacific, including the developed areas of Japan and Asia, Australia, New Zealand, the whole Asia Pacific is probably less than 20% of the global cat premium.
But with the potential to become a much larger percentage over time.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. And obviously, as you say, with after COVID, we'd expect quite a lot of money to be poured into infrastructure and things all over the world. But I would guess in Asia, that's probably going to be even more accelerated than we've seen lately.
Yes, definitely. One other area which I try always to explain is the different kind of spread we have in Asia. When you take Asia as one landmass, for instance, for typhoon, the correlations which we are seeing here, in the US, Florida, we have the correlation with the Caribbean, then Florida. And here we would see the Philippines, Taiwan, which is highly developed. And I mentioned this before, today the penetration ratio is 20%. Yes, there is a lot of life business in it, but the P&C business is also very well placed in the market. And then you have a correlation on the China coast. And then the other correlation is either South Korea or Japan. Mm. And these typhoons exist who are switching around and moving around in circles and changing their minds and moving around. And one of the most important example here is typhoon number 19, Mireille. That was 1991. And we have seen it, and it has been hitting all the markets all the way through. We have seen a younger one like Hato, which I mentioned before in the speech as well. This has not been hitting China alone. It has been hitting the Philippines first. And so every time we have typhoons here, we need to check on accumulations of our total portfolio along the correlated area. So it's much more complicated when you do your calculation on cat zones.
Mm, interesting. And of course, for the ILS market, as it increasingly looks to Asia as a new opportunity, both in terms of risk and investment capital, data is going to be vital, really, as ILS structures expand into that region. How is the data quality improving across the range of perils there? Are you finding much more granular data available all the time? Is it increasing quickly?
The amount of data and the appropriateness of data is improving all the time. I think if you're prepared to really put the effort into to accumulate the correct data, then it's available. I would just caveat that, you know, our industry is very good at sort of conflating the idea of quality with quantity, and when it comes to data, and therefore inferring that detail is accuracy, and those two are not really analog. And what we always need to do, whichever market we're in, is to gauge the appropriateness of data for the estimation of risk. Mm. And that's true wherever we are in the world.
Yeah, interesting. One of the topics you discussed during the keynote was crop exposures, particularly in India, which you say is well suited to sort of ILS structures. Now, obviously, it's short tail, it's weather related, it's It's the type of peril the ILS market certainly understands. But to what extent are sort of crop yields dependent on the monsoon, and how does that affect it? And I guess it would also be interesting to hear whether you see or have experienced changes in the pattern over the time, especially with relevance to climate change.
Well, it's a very young scheme. So the insurance experience of sensitivity to the monsoon seasons is not necessarily there.
Right.
But it's certainly true that, I think it's less than 30% of crops in India are irrigated and the rest are rain-fed. So it's very, very sensitive to the performance of the two monsoon seasons. And that's one of the reasons for the volatility in the results and the need for insurance and therefore capacity to back it.
Yeah, absolutely. During the keynote, you discuss the sort of growing value at risk opportunity in Asia, which is a fascinating prospect for traditional and alternative markets. But how do you envisage ILS and third-party capital playing a role in protecting those growing exposures over time?
Well, clearly wherever there's a large PML, then ILS or alternative capital is essential in protecting that. And if you look at Florida, where Lloyd's RDS scenario is for a loss in excess of $100 billion, that comes from Florida, which has a GDP of less than $1 trillion. So the Greater Bay Area is in the tropics, and as and when there is a GDP of $4 trillion, if there is a commensurate growth in insurance penetration, you can imagine the capacity that would be required to support and insure the same sort of insurance industry here, and therefore ILS capacity would be, again, essential.
Mm, absolutely. And France, I guess, it'd be interesting to hear your view on sort of the acquisition of Peak Capital and how that positions Peak Re now to become not just the only owner of a dedicated ILS manager in the Asia region, but also a conduit really for risk and capital in the region as well.
I think it has a lot to do with the growing PMLs which we see, and the key events which we look at is earthquake, for instance, in the Beijing Tianjin area. The other area, Sichuan PMLs for earthquake are increasing very rapidly. This is for cities like Chongqing and Chengdu. And Chongqing itself, it's a municipality. One needs to understand how the Chinese calling municipalities. That would be where I'm coming from, would be an entire province. But there are more than 40 million people living in that municipality. And so it's very densely built up. And it's in the foothills up the Himalayan and up to Tibet. And it's very impressive when you go there, but it's a very active earthquake zone. The other areas which we very well known is Japan, of course, windstorm and earthquakes, specifically Tokyo Bay earthquake. Then the other area is the entire coastal area of China, southern China, which is exposed to typhoon and so on. And then the Gujarat area in India and the area of northern, northeastern India, that's another area. And we see in all those areas, PMLs, as I described with your first questions, we see them rapidly increasing. So for us, it's very necessary to think about capital available and risk to capital. How do we want to structure this? How much can we put it on our own balance sheet? And how much do we want to build alternative balance sheets up so that we can feed the various kind of appetites, risk appetites, of the various kind of pots, I call it. And so our Lion Rock, which we came up with, I think 3 years ago, we got into planning. 2 years ago, we started it. This year is the second year. Now we are preparing for the next year. And so Lutis and now Peak Capital, really fits into that theory of thinking about how do we want to position it. From the onset, Peak Capital has a very interesting notion about what they are looking at the US, and we want them to be successful in this. But Lutis, over a longer period of time, or Peak Capital, need to get used to this, will be essential to our strategy, because here we have the structuring capabilities, we have the go-to-market capabilities, and we have the underwriting capabilities. Mm. And that combined together with PeakRe makes it much stronger. And so from a visionary perspective, I see that not only the risks and the PMLs are becoming larger, and we have an appetite for utilizing ILS as one of our risk-to-capital models, but also by looking at the growing interest in alternative investment possibilities by Asian investors. They become better educated. The Japanese are already very strongly educated. The Koreans are very strongly interested. And it's these two markets alone are huge capital providers. And then comes China, the growing China, with more and more interest in growing their alternative assets very strongly. So that's why we set it up. We set PeakRe up in Hong Kong because we believe in the region, and we believe that a Asian player with a global focus can play, and there is a value for it. But it can only come to fruition and to full fruition if we are playing on the entire possibilities which are there for us, and ILS is an essential part of modern reinsurance and risk management.
Thank you. That was very interesting. It will be really interesting to watch PeakRe and Peak Capital develop together, and how that can help you expand in your region and also globally as well. Thank you very much for your time today, and thank you very much for the keynote. I hope our viewers have enjoyed it, and I hope you both stay well, and look forward to talking to you both soon. Thank you.
Lots, Steve. All the best for you as well. Thank you.